Hello, I'm Marge Pryor, and welcome to my series of podcasts based on the oral history interviews I did for my book, Shooting at the Moon, which documented the UN peace process in Cambodia during 1993. In this episode, you will hear from a fearless young engineer, Clay Samchishian, who was one of three Australians contracted by Transfield as part of an Australian aid program to rebuild six bridges along Route 5, one of Cambodia's notorious highways that link Phnom Penh to Battambang. He didn't have access to UN security or flights and carried his own weapon for protection. At one construction site, they laid mines at night to protect themselves against the bandits and the Khmer Rouge. In one instance, Clay took on the bandits who tried to rob him at an illegal checkpoint.
I was in the middle of a malaria attack, and at the end of the day with malaria, you're drained. You've got that screaming headache that goes with it. And I was basically, I had a Khmer engineer with me, and we were going back. It was dark. We were stopped, and the guy asked for money. I was sufficiently pissed off and annoyed He just poked it through the window, stuffed it in my face, and asked me for Loy. I said, "Art Loy," and I just shoved it out of his road and shoved it back in his own face and told him to. My poor little Khmer engineer had hit the floor by this stage and disappeared, and I just drove off. But they didn't know. I went and saw them the next day because I was concerned that I'd get, buggerized about by it. And I went on my own. They saw me drive up. I talked to them, and they said that the guy concerned, who put the gun in my face, had a headache and he needed medicine. And I said, "Well, fair enough." So I went back to the car and I picked up a big block of paracetamol and I walked over to him and I threw them at him. I said, "Next time you've got a headache, take these. Don't point a gun in my face." Everyone laughed and I lost it. I've got a good relationship with them now. And you just can't afford not to.
Called King Clay by his team of Khmer workers, he lived with them on the bridge site in a rough open shelter where they often suffered from bouts of malaria.
It's all Khmer labour. They're all government employees. It's part of the infrastructure rehabilitation program between ADAB and UNDP. You can see it. Would you want to go down and have a look at it? We started in the wet, which probably wasn't the best time to do it, but it was the only time we had to start. We were here. We spent the first 2 months underwater, working sort of waist deep in water.
What's it say?
I don't see why that's very often. The bridge is designed in Australia. It was used. Similar bridges have been built in Indonesia with ADAB and Transfield again. You can see the watermarks on the pier where we're working. The water's right up to this level. You can see it laps in underneath here, so we'd be underwater right now. This side we started. We had that span there finished at the end of November. This we built in a month. The boys are learning quickly. They've got the system in their blood now and they seem to run on with it. A little bit of direction and they seem to do all right. This is the start of the truss. The truss is that's the first piece you can see. We're waiting for a link piece that goes back to the back of the deck, and it's like a big balanced beam, and we just build it piece by piece across. Put a concrete deck on it, and then it's ready to drive on. There's six bridges in the program. This is the first one. They stagger as they go up Route 5 to the other side of Battambang, spread over 300 kilometres. UNDP have engaged to do the substructure. ADAB have supplied the steel, which I think is around $2 million. I think the total cost of the project runs at about $5 million when it's all said and done. That's the roads and the bridges. I don't know, I got here in July, early July, and nothing was here. It was all meant to be started. I came with Transfield, and then I started rebuilding their equipment because most of it, it's Russian, it's archaic, and we've got a breakdown factor of about 5,000%. Every time we turn something on, it breaks down 10 times before we can get it to do something. That's the sort of things you put up against. The country's been in civil war for that long that everything they've got has run down. It's ill maintained. They've never had the money to maintain stuff, so when it breaks and that's it. It sits there and rusts. A lot of the equipment we found in the yard is had flat tyres, but brand new motors. I think there's a million bridges in Cambodia that need fixing. Mm. I've been all over Cambodia, right up through the east, and it's a mess. Every bridge that's ever built is blown up. A lot of the bridges are early French. They're built in around 1920s, 1930s, and a lot of those are still standing. They're well designed. They're a lot lighter than these structures. They're just simply supported spans, which means they're like a Lego set. They're a concrete girder composite bridge. There's a girder underneath which carries a load with a concrete deck.
How do they get all this concrete? In Australia, you see big concrete trucks. I haven't seen any.
We make it. We have a pile of rock, a pile of sand, and a mixer. and 0.3 of a metre every bowl. That usually takes us, we get about 3 metres an hour on average with one mixer. If we're doing a deck, we do a 60 metre pour like that. We use two mixers, two cranes, and about 100 men. And it goes all day, from daylight till dark. At the end of the day, you know you've done a day's work. The beer at the end of the day goes down well. We've sort of made that a tradition now, like it is internationally. The Cambodians, every time we pour concrete now, expect beer. So we build this house. That's the first job we do. And we live here. Lights, which we run off a big battery. Every time the wind blows, the floor gets an inch thicker. We've got two crews working on this bridge, so we get it finished. When we finish this one, we go up the road and help the guys because they're dragging their bums up further. It's because they're a lot further away from Phnom Penh. But this guy, this crew is now trained up. We've got a lot of good equipment. I think you'll find in 8 weeks we'll be finished here and we'll be on up the road.
Right.
I float between all six of them, but this is the main one where I sit at.
This is your bait.
Mm.
And is it dangerous? You've got a gun under your pillow.
Well, the Khmer Rouge are around most nights. The engineer doesn't live here anymore because they're threatened to kill him because he's educated. So what happens now is he's either got to be brought in or I bring him in depending if I'm in town. If I'm here, they don't seem to worry me because I'm white. They've come in, they've talked to us, and they've left. They go around, they terrorise the village, easily rob the tea houses and pinch beer. And I think I've got a little bit complacent about it. It's got to the stage where I see that much of it. And blood and guts and guns are boring now. It's not like it was when I got here. It was a little bit exciting. But I'm the local doctor. I patch up local kids and accidents. And I had a kid here that cut his ankle. I put 12 stitches in his ankle. I'd stitched sheep before, but never humans. It worked. He's got a good ankle. You can see the scar, but it's not testimony to my stitching, but it healed. It didn't, you know, they would have cut his foot off otherwise. We've had an accident on the corner where a guy's femur come through the side of his thigh, broke a femoral artery. I packed it and tied the artery in a knot and got it to the Germans, splintered the leg, put him in the back of the ute. Off we went. A fella there that's got the blue hat on, he had cerebral malaria before Christmas. He laid here for 2 days, got him to the Germans. He would have died otherwise. It's the sort of thing they put up with. They lay in bed. They either die or they don't die, and that's about all it boils down to. Well, they've actually got, I think, a good base knowledge of a lot of things. They're just used to doing it so hard. Civil wars really brought them right back down to nothing, to basic levels of existence. You can see that none of them are fat. And I'm 32-inch waist now. I was a 36 when I got here. That's malaria and an amoeba that's sort of trimmed me off.
When did you get the malaria?
About 3 weeks after I got here. And I got four or five different attacks before they found it because I was different parts of Cambodia, nowhere near a doctor. The last time I got it, I was in Phnom Penh, so they took a malaria smear and found it. So I've been treated for it. I haven't had another attack since. When I do, I take a handful of doxycycline, or if I think I'm getting it. But the amoeba I got before Christmas, and that's a lot worse.
What's that?
That's a parasite in your intestine. And I just haven't been able to eat for a month. You see, I waste away. I've never been able to do that in my life. Put my hand around my wrist. It's usually nice and thick. And my waist. You can see the different stages of Cambodia. When you land, malaria, amoeba.
I caught up with Clay in Phnom Penh some months later as he was preparing to start work on another bridge.
We've now got a lot of young engineers and young people who are willing but don't have the background and experience. That 30 to 45-year-old age bracket, your middle management area, it's not there. So you need, these guys can build Bailey bridges, but their concrete technology and advanced levels of engineering aren't there. They've learned it in the books from the Russians and the Vietnamese. But when you've got to get out there and do it, and you've got to learn to handle men, for a 25-year-old man who's as green as grass, to handle a crew of 50 men who are older and have lived through wars and are sometimes very difficult to handle, they're faced with some pretty serious problems. So you've got to get in at all levels, and that means from implementing them to get them going, to motivate them, which means paying them more money, giving them incentives, setting target dates, getting involved with them, living with them. Actually, if you set up and live with them on the bridge, you get a lot of respect from them because you don't separate yourself then. They're very keen to learn. Computer technology they want to learn about, but they've got limited access to it because site work is always like that, and it's also money. When I first conceived the program, no one wanted to work any further north than where we were started. Now I had a volunteer list of about 100 men to go north of Battambang, which is, it's going to warm up, it's going to be a nasty spot to work. But the guys are there because of the bonus, because they now got respect in their own engineers because they're starting to make the right decisions. You know, they've learnt the hard way. My basis of bridge building is you try for perfection, you end up with, 20% off that. And with the Cambodians, they've learned that. And then when we opened that bridge, that first one, everyone was really proud. It's very straight, it's very clean, it's very neat. A lot of heartache went into it, like I made them tear things down and do it again and jackhammer decks out that weren't vibrated correctly, and they thought I was nuts. I just thought it loopy. But at the end of the day, when we sat down and had a beer, it was all done. They all walked around and thought, they all want photos of it. It's the first bridge rebuild in Cambodia. They're all as proud as punch. We all were. And the day they opened it, I said to them, I said, you can look at it, it's straight. No one can pick a fault with it. That's all that effort. And now they appreciate that. And it's being reproduced in the other bridges. It is having effect. It is working. And it's worth all the heartache and, you know. The 1st of April, we opened it. 2 o'clock, we opened the bridge. Look, it was a great day. I'd come down from another bridge. On that day, we drove down and we arrived. And I'd left the boys alone for that 3 weeks. I'd been down a couple of times to see that everything was going okay. And they'd completed it unsupervised, which was great. They did the road approaches and they'd done all the finishing work. And by that stage, they were sufficiently proud to finish it correctly. All the details, even getting little things out of the creek. And we had a big tent pitch for the opening. And I stayed and got drunk with them until 10 o'clock. They picked me up and threw me around and did the usual thing, you know, King Clay, something like that.
King Clay.
Yeah. I get a lot of respect out of them. And I don't know, I suppose it's recognition for the effort.
And who officially opened the bridge?
We had the Ambassador for Australia, right. John Holloway. We had...
the ADAB people?
Well, Perry was
there.
Mr. Draper, I can't remember his first name. He's the administrator for UNDP. SNC, a senior member of the SNC there. The two of them opened it, three of them.
And all the villages?
Oh, yeah.
So we would have had thousands of locals.
We had a mass. They're all over the bridge. We blocked the bridge off and we had put a photographic display on some of the photos I'd taken. It was a mixture of technical photographs, but a lot of people, you know, the commuters coming through it, working chest deep in water and all that sort of garbage, because we had a month of rain there where we were all up to here in water. That was particularly difficult, but they committed themselves to it, and that was part of a bonus too. You know, we completed that work in 3 weeks, and they got a $200 bonus for the crew from it. And that was when I started the bonus. That was the first thing. That was actually the bonus in the piles was the starting work. And after that, we had to actually physically get into the water because the rains had come and the level had lifted 3 metres, so we were underwater. We had a bit of a deal going, but they did the first half of the bridge Khmer way, and I just let it go. I wasn't going to get involved in an argument. I told them I could do it better and quicker and whatever. So they did it their way. When they pissed around, and I just went along with them. And then we did the other half. Now, the first half of the bridge, which was the substructure and the deck, took something like 3.5 months. The second half took us 27 days from the pile cap to the finished deck. And they all looked at me and just, okay, no problems. And from then on, anything I said, it was just no argument. It was like, okay, we'll do it your way. We erected the truss, the main span truss, in 8 days, and it's never been done that quickly anywhere in the world before. It was a particular system that I conceived before I left. It was very simple. They acquitted themselves very well. They just listened. I was without my engineer then. Tommy had amoebic dysentery, and so I just had the Khmer. So I had to rely on my Khmer language, which is, it's reasonable now, and my drawing skills, so sketches. And the boys, they had that enough respect that they just listened to anything I said and showed them. And I had the background erecting transmission towers that I knew exactly what had to be done. So we just jumped in and it flew. I mean, it surprised everyone. And that allowed us to open the bridge quickly. August we spent underwater. September we spent underwater. October we started to get out of it. But the water was still there until around about the end of November. So what we had to do, we had to concentrate on one span. We got in and we did that work underwater behind sandbag walls. And, you know, we used to fill a big aluminium tinny up with mud and build these bag walls and plug the holes and pump the water out. And sort of, we didn't have any equipment, and that was about all we could do. It was a sandbag wall, a levee bank. But we had to build it in the river. But we were working on fill, so it was pervious. The water was coming in as quick as we could pump it out. The lead time associated with working in Cambodia is dictated by the rains. If it starts raining in China, it doesn't have to rain in Cambodia. It rains in China, the Mekong floods. It drives the level of the Tonle Sap up. Actually, the river runs backwards in Cambodia. And that's why Cambodia is known as the rice bowl of Asia. It floods. It floods most of central Cambodia. And you get a water level lift 4 metres. Well, it means you've got to go to a different style of bridge building. You're not working on dry land. You're working on water, which is very difficult. And that's just another equipment that we haven't got. You know, ADAB this year, I think, are committed to part of their budget is to equipment, which is my recommendation, because we physically can't. I mean, we're at the stage where unless we get $1 million worth of key equipment to replace this garbage they've got, and if they have got a serious commitment to infrastructure rehabilitation, then they will commit themselves to this. Maybe reduce the bridges to 3 and have a sizable commitment to equipment replacement. And then carry the bridge company as their second arm for the next 5 or 6 years, develop it and leave it in 5 years, leave Cambodia with a trained nucleus of staff with a reasonable equipment base, and maybe 2 dozen bridges. I mean, and that to me would be a successful aid program. It's not a matter of just going in there and building bridges. I mean, we could throw contractors in there and build them in 12 weeks, but that defeats the whole purpose. If the place does go to civil war and they do lose the bridge, they then have people then are capable of rebuilding a bridge. The Cambodian people have, you know, a strong will, and they apply that at an academic level. They don't place themselves above anyone because they are educated. They're committed, they're respected as such by their workers.
you know, they sleep in a little area and they eat differently, but they still, they're out in the, you know, in the scrub in the jungle, dirt floors and bamboo huts, and they're there for weeks on end. Their wives live in Phnom Penh, where they're safe, their children are safe there, and they mightn't go back to see them for 3 or 4 months. They might go back for 3 days and then they're back out again. And as you know, all the bridge sites are armed. I mean, we carry mines on site, we carry rockets, we carry everything, rifles. We have armed guards at night, mainly for theft. One of the bridges we mine at night for theft. We've had 2 people shot there. Our guy shot 2 of the people. There was one night we were asleep, a rifle shot and another one, and stuck my head out the window. And the boys had, were running out to the barge, and the local army were down there, and they'd shot. There was a husband and wife were stealing off the barge, just timber. It was just a ridiculous amount. It was nothing. And they'd killed a woman with the first shot, and the second shot, they hit the man in the hip. They dragged him back off and chained him to a tree for the night and left him there. I'm sparing you all the gory details. The next morning, they took him to Basat, tried him. The magistrate said he was to be kept alive and taken back out and shot in the village as an indicator to everyone that theft isn't tolerated. I mean, they have nothing. So theft over there is a capital offence. I mean, it's... I mean, if you can understand it. I mean, they just don't tolerate theft. They can't, and that's why they're very honest people. They very are. I mean, we most of the program, we place a lot of faith in their administration handling money, the way it was originally set up. And we've never had a problem with them. And that day they just hung this guy up in a tree and shot him. And it was a pretty gruesome thing. They're not particularly remorseful. They've got a... There's no compassion involved in anything. From time when I've got malaria, I just lay there and take it. The first time I got it, I found it hard to take, laying there, you know, in a horrible sweat and a fever. I just lay there and take it. I mean, they come and look at you every now and again. They get a giggle out of it. They laugh at you because you're white and you actually get sick. We've got access to all sorts of medicines. And I carry a first aid kit, a pretty solid one, with me all the time, and they rely on me for that side of the first aid. Well, now we fund that. We give them their own first aid kit and their engineers administer paracetamol. They've got horrible problems with headaches and diarrhea and things like that. And now they've got their own needles. They can sew themselves up.
So what about the Khmer Rouge? Are they, do they target those intelligent people?
Yeah, we had that just before Christmas. I did a road recce north, and I came back and there was a problem. The Khmer Rouge had come in one night. And my engineer on that first bridge was asleep. And he had an old foreman there who's a pretty switched-on sort of guy. And the Khmer Rouge came in, they wanted to know all about the bridge. Were the Vietnamese doing it? Or the government, were they doing it? And he said, no, the Australians were doing it. And they said, well, who's running it? And they said, well, the engineer's back in Phnom Penh. Now, Whitney was asleep. And they said that they'd kill him. That he was, that was their, you know, their philosophy on life is instilled by Pol Pot. And it frightened the bejesus out of Woodney. So he went back to Phnom Penh and he was brought in and out every day, which is a shame because he was getting very competent and on top of everything. His father was bayoneted in front of him as a five-year-old. So they went that day when they came through and terrorised that bridge, that engineer, that whole village, packed up and moved. They were in there that night. They robbed a tea house. They kicked the door down, stole a heap of beer and whatever, burnt the tea house down. Well, that spread through the village, you know, like they were there. There was 14 men, 14 Khmer Rouge soldiers. Well, they were dressed in Khmer Rouge uniforms. What they wore, who they were, no one can, you never can tell this. But as a result, we're building that bridge. It was like a morgue. The villages had just disappeared. And at 5 o'clock at night, I was warned to get out of there, make sure I was on the road after 4 o'clock. I don't know whether I was stupid or brave, but it didn't enter into my head that we were working and I wasn't going to let anyone intimidate us. And then the guys that were working with us were appreciative of the fact that I wasn't concerned. I said to them, this isn't a Vietnamese-funded bridge, it's Australian. We've got a big bamboo pole and put the Aussie flag up on the abutment. It was really unsettling there for a couple of weeks. The guys were very flighty. They could see the worst happening again because they've lived through it. These guys have built bridges and having to fight. That was just after a rocket attack we had. We had a rocket attack in November where we had a rocket land 30 metres from a bridge abutment. When that happened, I mean, it could have been the CAPAF stirring trouble. At that time, the SOC, the government that was there, was trying to whip up this all this anti-Khmer Rouge feeling so that I think they were trying to get the UN on side to do something military. That our engineer was warned of was that you vote, you die. And that was sufficient. Everyone said, well, why the hell should we vote? What for? Why would we risk our lives for an election?
Clay went on to work in Afghanistan, building roads for an American company.
Basically, when I got home in 93 to when I left in 2001, I went back to Cambodia to do a road program. So I did that program working for, I was rail and road. So I did work for the Cambodian Railways and was very familiar with the country, so covered a lot of ground, did two major roads and a heap of track work. And I met a guy from an American company while I was in Cambodia who offered me a job in Afghanistan. So I went from Cambodia to Afghanistan and ran a very large road program there. We did 1,500 kilometres of roads between January 2004 and 3 years. I was only there two. I handed over to my deputy in the third year. It was part of a large infrastructure program at the time, and I headed up the section that built provincial roads, which are the roads around all of the districts off the arterial roads in Afghanistan. So I was very fortunate enough to see every corner of the country, either by helicopter or four-wheel drive. So at one point, I think we had 52 Aussies working for us and a total workforce of about 6,000 men, which included 12 international contractors, Turkish and Indian, building roads all over the country. We had good security. I mean, the risk was always there. There were always issues. We had a couple of tragedies. We had an Australian helicopter pilot shot in 2004. His security guy that was working with him at the time was injured and out of operation for 18 months and came back and worked for me. He had a female engineer with him who went back to America. And I think she suffered the ill effects of that incident, which was really quite nasty, and Mark left behind a widow and a young daughter here in Australia. So that was a pretty dreadful event. And after that, we had, you know, incidents through the entire program, I think. The company I worked for, we lost over 52 people over the course of the 2 years I was there. So, yeah, Afghanistan's a place where the people are remarkable. Some of them are so good, so giving. You go into villages and meet people who would give you their last piece of bread or butter or egg. And then, of course, there's the other side of the political fence, which, yeah, gets on the worst side of people. I think religion has that effect. It either makes people really good or really bad. Doesn't seem to be in between. But a lot of Afghans are focused on survival. That's their number one priority. And I think that's probably still more true now than ever. Then I went to Turkey, went on to India. I was building a road between Gardez and Host. I was working for an Indian company. And Gardez Host is, you know, it runs parallel to the Pakistan border. We were never able to build the entire road because it just got too crazy towards the end. They didn't want the centre section made out of bitumen. So we were regularly attacked. We had mortars in our camp. We were in contact with the American forward operating bases in the area, and we would get, I don't know whether it was insurgents, you never know who it is, but they would position 50 cal machine gun, Dushkas, on the mountain above the camp. We were working for an American contractor at the time. They were the prime, and they positioned the camp at the base of a big hill, which was kind of stupid. But we fortified the camp. We took mortar fire and 50 cal machine gun fire. So we had little bunkers dug beside our accommodation. I've got a 50 cal round I give to my partner. It was, every man's got a bullet with his name written on it. Well, that one went through the eave and spun across my nose one night as I was heading for the bunker. I didn't spill a drop of rum and coke, though, I will tell you that. There's another one in Africa where I had just a bandit on the side of the road, shot my front left tyre out, and then drove another one through the windscreen between the passenger seat and the driver's seat, and then the third one into the engine block just as I hit him. So I look back to Istanbul, which became my second home over the years, and I got involved in, I've always been involved in contractual dispute resolution. So the last one was a big project in Kazakhstan that went to Paris for an ICC arbitration, which was a 5 or 6 year effort. So that was flying between Istanbul, London and Moscow because we had Russian lawyers, English experts, and the arbitration was in Paris. So the contractors were in Turkey. So I lived in Istanbul and commuted. My family lived in Los Angeles, so I flew backwards and forwards to see the kids and their mum. So yeah, spent a lot of years on planes after that.
That was Clay Samchisian, an Australian engineer who has spent more than 20 years working overseas on infrastructure programs in third world countries. Next episode, I'll bring you the story of how 360,000 Cambodian returnees were brought back home from the Thai border camps to vote in the elections.
We've been forced to withdraw from that area during that secessionist movement. We would have been highly embarrassed and it would have had a profound effect on the mission.
This is Marge Pryor, author and publisher of Shooting at the Moon. You can go to my website, www.cambodianpeaceworkers.com.au, to listen to these podcasts or purchase my book, Shooting at the Moon. Thank you for listening to my podcast. I'd like to acknowledge the following people who've helped me make them possible. Andrea Close, consultant producer. Tim Roebuck, sound engineer and studio recordist. Aaron Hopper, composer and musician. These podcasts have been produced with the support of the Australian Government.